Becatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Becatra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're putting on our critical thinking caps, you could say. We're going to look at the world a bit differently, taking apart the everyday stuff around us, using Roland Barthes' really important book, Mythologies.
Yeah, this is such a key deep dive because Barthes basically throws down a challenge. He wants you to question all the assumptions that, you know, make up your reality.
So the mission today is
to pull out that toolkit he gives us. Because if you can start decoding the hidden meanings in ads, in media, even in, like, the objects on your table, well, it really does feel like gaining a kind of superpower. You start seeing the hidden messages shaping everything.
And that's why it feels so relevant now, maybe more than ever. We're just swimming in signs, aren't we? Ads, political talk, social media. Yeah. It's constant.
Constant saturation. And Barthes gives us the tools, like an intellectual self-defense kit, to navigate all that noise and figure out what's really being said underneath it all. It's about learning to read our culture.
Learning to read the code, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the codebreaker himself, Roland Barthes. Who was this guy?
Right. So Roland Barthes, a French thinker, writer, theorist,
right,
lived 1915 to 1980. A major figure in structuralism, post-structuralism.
Yeah.
Basically applying ideas from linguistics to, well, everything else.
He bridged that gap between really academic theory and just daily life, didn't he?
He absolutely did. And what makes him so distinctive, I think, is that he took semiotics, the study of signs, building on Saussure, and applied it where maybe others wouldn't have bothered.
Like where?
Like mundane stuff, popular culture, things academics usually ignored, cars, wrestling matches, steak and chips, advertisements.
Right. Things people thought were just trivial. He treated them seriously, like texts to be decoded.
Yeah.
He was like a cultural detective, refusing to accept that things are just the way they are.
Totally. He called himself a mythologist. And he wouldn't take things at face value. He kept asking, why does this mean what it seems to mean? And who actually benefits from that meaning?
Okay, let's unpack the main idea of mythologies. He talks about myths everywhere in modern society, but not like Greek gods.
No, not ancient myths. He means modern myths. These are systems of communication, ways of making meaning that are all around us, subtly shaping how we understand everything.
And how do they work? You mentioned a second order language.
Yeah, that's the core idea, and it's brilliant. Modern myth takes something simple, a concept, an object, maybe a picture, and then injects it with a hidden ideological message.
An ideology, like a political viewpoint.
Often, yeah. Barthes argued these myths usually serve the interests of the dominant culture, what he called the bourgeoisie.
Okay, so the big problem he's tackling is how that dominant group makes its specific beliefs and values seem completely normal.
Yeah.
Exactly. Natural, universal, like they've always been true and always will be. The goal is to make the current way things are, the status quo, feel like the only way things could be. Inevitable.
And myth is the mechanism for doing that.
That's the perfect tool. It basically takes an object or an idea, strips away its actual history, its complexity, maybe the politics or the labor involved in making it,
yeah,
and presents it as something simple, obvious, just common sense. And by doing that, it kind of shuts down critical thinking. It makes the way things are seem like the natural order.
And the book itself reflects this. It has two parts, right?
Yeah, it's cleverly structured. Part one is like the evidence locker, 53 short, sharp essays looking at specific examples, the case studies. Then part two, called Myth Today, is where he lays out the theory, the how it works explanation.
Okay, let's dive into that theory part then. The second order semiological system. Sounds a bit intimidating.
It can sound that way, but let's break it down. It builds on basic semiotics, the study of signs.
Right. You mentioned Saussure. So what's a basic sign, just to be clear? Good place to start. So in the first system, basic language, a sign has two bits. There's the signifier that's the physical part, like the sound rose or a picture of a rose.
Okay, the word or the image.
And then there's the signifier. That's the mental concept, the idea of the flower itself.
Got it.
Put the signifier and signify together, and boom, you get the sign. The meaningful rose, word plus concept, meaning. Simple enough.
Makes sense. So where does myth come in?
Right. This is the clever part.
Mm-hmm.
Myth operates on top of that. That first level sign, the meaningful rose, the whole package of image and concept, it gets kind of hollowed out. It becomes just the raw material, the signifier, for a new second level meaning.
Wait, so the actual rose, the sign itself, becomes just the starting point for a different idea.
Exactly. That whole rose sign is now used to signify something else, an ideological concept, like a romantic passion or maybe French national pride if it's on a certain product. The miss is that second layer of meaning that gets tacked on.
Okay. And the power of it is that the original meaning with the flower is still kind of there, visible.
That's the key. It's still partly present, which makes the new meaning, the ideology like romance, feel completely natural, like it grew out of the rose itself. It doesn't feel forced or political.
It feels obvious.
Right. Let's make it concrete. Think about his famous example, wrestling.
Ah, yes, the wrestling essay. He says it's not really a start, is it?
Not in the sense of genuine competition, no. He sees it as pure spectacle. It's theater, a performance of really exaggerated moral ideas.
Like good versus evil played out.
Exactly. The huge bodies, the over-the-top gestures, the grimaces of pain, they're all signs. They communicate really clear, unambiguous moral messages. Justice, suffering, betrayal. It's all laid out for the audience to read easily. People go to see morality performed, not a contest.
Okay, but here's a question. Does this mean we can't just enjoy wrestling?
Yeah.
Or anything? Yeah. Does everything become some kind of manipulation if we apply Barthes?
That's a really important point. Barthes isn't saying you can't enjoy it. The crucial thing is awareness. The myth works best when you enjoy the spectacle, the signifier, the performance, without consciously thinking about the ideology, the concept that's being smuggled in. Awareness is the antidote.
That distinction helps. Okay, let's shift to maybe his most famous political example, the Paris Match cover.
Yes, this one is so powerful. He analyzes this magazine cover photo, a young black soldier in a French army uniform, saluting, eyes looking up, presumably at the flag.
Just the image itself, the literal photo, what Barthes calls the form, seems straightforward enough.
On the surface, yes, just a soldier saluting. But then, Barthes says, this form is filled with an enormous ideological concept.
Which is?
The myth of a great, benevolent French empire. The idea that all colonial subjects are happy, loyal citizens proudly serving France. It suggests Frenchness and military service transcend race.
And the danger is?
The danger is how effectively this myth depoliticizes the image. It uses the soldier's apparent loyalty to completely erase the actual history of colonialism. The violence, the oppression, the resistance. It makes French imperial power look like a natural, accepted fact, not a contested political reality.
Wow. So it turns something deeply political into something that looks like just patriotism.
Precisely. It transforms history into nature. But it wasn't just big politics, right? He applied the same lens to everyday things, like kids' toys.
Absolutely. This one really makes you think. Barthes looked at the toys popular, then miniature versions of adult tools, dolls that wet themselves, complex construction sets, and argued they weren't really about fostering free imagination.
So what were they about?
He saw them as conditioning tools. They subtly prepare children for the roles they're expected to fill as adults in a consumer society.
How so?
Well, dolls might prepare girls for domestic roles, focusing on nurturing or appearance. Miniature kitchens, tool sets. They prepare kids, often boys, for specific kinds of work, and, importantly, for being consumers. The myth is that play is innocent and free. Barthes reveals it as a form of early social and economic training.
Trading them to be little consumers and workers.
Pretty much. Okay, so if we zoom out from these examples, what are the big recurring themes in mythologies?
Well, the first and maybe biggest is what we've been touching on. The naturalization of ideology.
Making the political seem natural.
Exactly. Myth's main job is to take something historical, constructed, political, like class structure or gender roles, and make it look like it's just the way things are. Natural, eternal, obvious. The most effective power is an invisible power, the kind you don't even question.
And the second theme relates to who benefits, the bourgeoisie, you said.
Yes. Theme two is the bourgeoisie's anonymity. Jarthus points out that the dominant class, the ones pushing these myths, tend to operate without naming themselves as the bourgeoisie.
What do you mean?
They present their specific values, like maybe the importance of private property or individualism or consumerism, not as bourgeois values, but as human nature or common sense or what everyone wants. He called this exnomination the act of not being named.
So they define the rules, but pretend they aren't the ones writing the rule book.
Right. They claim universality, which leads to the third theme.
The power of the mundane.
Yeah. This is where Barthes is so revolutionary for cultural studies. He insists that nothing is culturally innocent. The big ideological battles aren't just fought in parliaments or protests. They're fought on the terrain of everyday life. Our food, our clothes, our cars, detergent ads.
So studying pop culture isn't trivial, it's essential.
It's where the myths live and breathe.
Barthes also had this incredible knack for summing up huge ideas in really memorable lines. We should probably touch on a few key quotes.
Definitely. They really stick with you. The absolute core one has to be, It is the very principle of myth. It transforms history into nature.
That just nails it, doesn't it? It's the mission statement. What history is being erased here to make this feel inevitable?
Exactly. And then, related to that anonymity point, the bourgeoisie is defined as the social class which does not want to be named.
That explains so much about why dominant ideas feel so ambient. They hide by claiming to be for everyone.
Yeah. And one more, maybe a bit more provocative, about the Citroën DS car he analyzed. I think that cars today are almost the exact equivalent of the great Gothic cathedrals.
Wow. Okay. Comparing a car to a cathedral, what's he getting at there?
He's saying that modern consumer objects, like this high-tech car,
yeah,
have become these almost magical things. They're presented as smooth, seamless objects of desire, completely detached from the messy reality of their production, the labor, the factories. They inspire this kind of quasi-religious faith in technology and consumption as salvation.
Stripping away the history again, the industrial reality.
Making it pure, desirable form.
So how do we take this toolkit and actually use it now in our world?
Oh, it's incredibly applicable. Think about advertising today. Any ad, really.
Give me an example.
Okay, say an ad for a luxury watch. The ad isn't just selling a device that tells time, the form. It's selling a myth. The concept maybe of success or sophistication or control over time or legacy.
Right. It attaches this bigger idea to the object.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the Barthesian questions are, what myth, what value is actually being sold here? And what's being conveniently ignored? Maybe the environmental cost, the labor conditions where it was made, the fact that status is being constructed.
And social media feels like a myth factory nonstop.
Oh, absolutely. Think about influencer culture. That supposedly authentic glimpse into someone's everyday life, often featuring perfectly placed products, curated backgrounds.
Hashtag morning routine posts.
Right. It's a carefully constructed myth. Often it's a myth of achievable perfection or effortless wellness or aspirational lifestyle. And what does it do? It naturalizes consumerism. It makes buying specific things seem like the natural pathway to happiness or belonging.
It makes the constructed look spontaneous.
And we can use Barthas to challenge ideas that just feel like common sense, like this whole hustle culture thing.
The idea that working yourself to the bone is virtuous.
Yeah. Barthas would push us to ask, why do we accept this as a good thing? Who actually benefits when long hours and constant productivity are framed as moral virtues, rather than, say, potentially exploitative labor practices? What history of workers' rights is being ignored when we celebrate the hustle?
It forces you to ask, who profits from this common sense?
Exactly. Follow the benefit.
Looking back at the book, what really struck you the most?
For me, I think it was that dawning realization of the political weight hidden in seemingly trivial things. The idea that you could analyze a wrestling match or an ad with the same rigor you'd apply to a political speech and find profound insights about power. That was mind-blowing. It changes how you see everything.
Yeah, I agree. For me, the biggest takeaway is how it empowers the reader. It turns you from just passively absorbing culture into an active decoder, a mythologist yourself. It really is like getting a new pair of glasses. You start seeing the layers everywhere. It's an intellectual toolkit for navigating the world.
Definitely. And maybe the final provocative thought to leave people with is just to be suspicious of the word natural. Whenever something, an idea, a product, the social structure is presented to you as simply natural or obvious or the way things have always been.
That's the moment to pause.
That's the moment Barthas would say, stop. Ask, says who? And crucially, why? Why is it being presented this way? And who benefits from you accepting it without question?
A powerful question to keep asking. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.